Hi, this is Joe Ziemba, and I'm the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers, and all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.
Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on a grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, Deft. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
The first pick is a sure thing. And maybe the second pick, that's the consolation prize. But the third overall pick, that's where the NFL draft gets interesting and weird. It's the slot that gave us the dominance of Barry Sanders and the greatness of Larry Fitzgerald, but it's also the graveyard of can't-miss prospects who never saw a second contract. From franchise-altering icons to cautionary tales, we're diving into the chaotic, high-stakes history of the NFL's most unpredictable podium spot with our guest, Ed Cleese, who's joined us for all 32 of these great NFL draft history slots of the draft. Now, we're going into the pig pen once more. Pigskin Dispatch's 32-day journey. This is the legacy of the pick number 3 in the NFL draft. If you're just tuning in, we are 3 days before the NFL draft in Pittsburgh of 2026, and we are counting down the days. We have 32 straight days where we're talking about the selections of each slot, 32 down to one, to correspond with these days. My co-part in this whole endeavor has been Ed Cleese. Ed, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, how are you today?
I'm doing super, Ed. We are right down to the wire here now. People are starting to arrive in Western Pennsylvania, get ready for the draft. Probably the players are coming in, coaches, everybody's getting all set here and really pumped up for this great event coming up.
Schools are shut down. Work is closed. All the roads are closed. All the bars are staying open later. The kids that were supposed to be in school, they're going to let them go to the bars. I think that's what's happening in Pittsburgh.
We take football serious here in Pennsylvania.
Apparently. Well, I'm sure it's going to be one heck of a fun week.
I'm sure it will be. It could be a blast here coming up. But we've had some blasts from the past as we've been talking about the history of these draft slots. And today, draft slot number 3 has some great history. What was your take on the history?
Well, it's time to get very selective because I think we've reached the point now, Darren, with these top 3 picks where I'm going back to 1980. So we're talking about 45 years of picks. I bet that you will pretty much remember every single one of these guys that was picked, even the ones that didn't turn out, because if you're kind of tuning into the draft yearly, you know, you usually know the guys that are going at the top. So there's just so many recognizable names, good or bad, that it's going to be impossible for us to talk about even the majority of them. There is recent years are been pretty good, pretty darn good. There appears to be maybe one massive bust that's getting close to being a real massive bust, but Abdul Carter went there last year, Drake May, Will Anderson, Derek Stingley. We're talking about, you know, some really big time players in recent years. There is a little bit of an ugly history for some busts. So I think we need to talk about those too.
Okay. Well, let's undust those and talk about them.
Yeah. We're going to talk about number five, the number five biggest bust ever taken third overall is Joey Harrington. Taken in 2002, quarterback by the Lions. I actually didn't want to put him on here because he was taken by such a miserable franchise at a miserable time. You know, that was before they went, you know, 0-16. That this was like the lead up to that. They were doing poorly. They were not faring well. And then things just got worse. So it's hard to know with him. His career record, unlike some of the bust quarterbacks, he actually did start a lot of games. So his career record was 26-50. But one thing was that I looked at is like his year one and then year two kind of got worse, which is that's not the trend that we want. He led the league in interceptions and he finished his career with more interceptions than touchdowns, which is not normal for that era of football. You know, we saw that somewhat more in the past where the quarterbacks were throwing a lot of picks. Not really once we get to the 2000s and 2010s. And then the other thing is he played for Miami. He played for Atlanta. Unlike some of these other quarterbacks that had a nice second act, he didn't. So he got a couple extra chances. He never panned out. And unfortunately, just he makes our list.
Yeah. He had a lot of promise, a lot of hope. People in Detroit were happy when they got him, but just never hit the limelight like they wanted.
Yes. And going on to number four. Even worse would be Trent Richardson, 2012 running back taken by the Browns. Only played three total seasons. His rookie year was okay. And then the next year, Darren, the Colts gave up a first-round pick for him. And I would say if you're the Colts, man, is that not a giant red flag that the team that just drafted this guy number three a year ago is willing to already trade him? So for once, the Browns may have made a smart move. They actually got a first back for Trent Richardson, who did nothing in Indianapolis. He got demoted, then he got suspended, then he's out of the league. And my friend Joe, the Browns fan, he put it pretty simple. He said, it's pretty easy to summarize Trent. He did not like football. And that is problematic. But I have a funny Browns twist to this story. They got the first round pick back from the Colts. Do you know who they took with that first round pick that they received from the Colts?
Was it that the Courtney Brown?
No.
Okay.
It was Johnny Football.
Oh, Manziel. Okay.
So they drafted Richardson, massive bust, thought they were the smart guys to get the first round pick, and then somehow took an even bigger bust with Johnny Football. So leave it to the Browns, even when they get somebody to bail them out. They're saying, no, we will not accept your gift. We are going to blow it again. So, sorry, Joe.
Yeah. All right. So, who do you have next?
Number three is a guy that, you know, every now and then I say we remember all these guys. This was one where I had to, like, really squint. I was like, oh, yeah. Deion Jordan, a defensive end taken in 2013 by the Dolphins. He had five career starts. And it looks like he had almost as many drug suspensions. So that's really his story, was just problems off the field, didn't play a lot, didn't get many chances, and was see you later.
Yeah, that doesn't mix well with a professional sports career.
No, and this does – a lot of these busts we talk about, Darren, you're noticing a trend, right? There's a lot of guys we talk about that can't get themselves together off the field – trickles onto the field. So again, we talked about it a lot, man. Do your homework, teams.
Yeah. And I'm glad the NFL is putting a lot more programs into their rookie symposiums and everything, try to get people educated to, you know, get out of the wrong crowds and bad habits and get into something more conducive to having a good career.
For sure.
All right. So who do you have next?
Number two is a guy that apparently is a great dude. And probably worked hard and just did not work out, though. Number two is Akili Smith, drafted in 1999, quarterback, another quarterback out of Oregon. But this one by the Bengals, he had a 3-14 career record. And 12 of those starts came in his second year. So it's like the Bengals saw him in year two and it was like, that's enough for everybody. He only had, this is the other thing that's crazy. So that's still 17 starts, Darren. He only had 5 touchdown passes. Like, how do you start 17 games in the NFL and only throw 5 touchdowns? He had a 46% completion percentage. I mean, that's just terrible. But the one of the worst thing about this is I am forever saddled with Achilles Smith because I made a comment prior to the draft to my friends that they still bring up to this day and make fun of me for. I happened to be watching a pre-draft analysis show and Joe Theismann was on and he was talking about Achilles Smith and how he had some of the best revolutions on his passes. Like when he threw the ball, there was more revolutions. I don't know how Joey T was measuring this back in 1999, probably just something silly that Joey T was saying. But anyway, I was dumb enough to repeat it to my friends. I was like, you know what? They're going to take that Achilles Smith guy. He's awesome. He has way more revolutions on his passes than the other quarterbacks that they might get taken. And so for years, like he flamed out very quickly. And so for years and years, they made fun of me. And to this day, whenever the draft comes around, people will text me or call me and say, oh, Ed, how many revolutions does this quarterback have on his passes? Are you going to analyze this for us? So thank you, Joe Theismann and Achilles Smith, for giving me something that has followed me for, I guess, 27 years now.
Yeah. Well, you deserve to be made fun of. Yep. So I'm glad that your buddies still rib you about it. Yep. That's all right. So who do you have next on your list?
Number one, I've got another story that's going to be kind of embarrassing for me, Darren. Number one is Heath Shuler, taken in 1994 quarterback by the Redskins. You know, he went 4-5 with the Saints in his last year, and he went 4-9 with the Redskins. He had a 15 touchdown to 33 interception ratio, but he wasn't done there because he also had 13 fumbles. And a couple things. He was, you know, the Redskins were, the first time they were bad was 1993. That's the first time the Redskins were bad in my lifetime. And the reward for that, of course, was they had the third pick in the draft. And we had never had like a young, exciting quarterback in the Gibbs era. So I was excited. We had just hired Norv Turner, did this offensive guru, and now we're going to get our quarterback. I was so excited when they took Heath Shuler. I went down to a local mall, and I guess whatever the equivalent to the Lids store was back then, you know, the hat store, I had them custom make a hat. It was a black hat with burgundy writing, and it said Heath Shuler in cursive, number 5. And so this was like my pride. I got this right after the draft, okay? And then I remember I was watching them in a preseason game, and it was like, oh, no. Uh-oh. This doesn't look – he looked, Darren, like he could not play football. Like
I think you should have wore this hat to this episode.
I can't. I'll tell you why. About a year and three quarters later, the end of the 95 season, they were 18-point underdogs playing Dallas late in the year, the future champion Cowboys. And I ritualistically discarded the hat with a fellow Redskin fan. We did like a ceremony where we like threw it away, burned it. We did something. What's funny is right after that, the Redskins pulled off one of the greatest upsets in regular season history. They beat Dallas in Dallas. And that was like the one game where Shuler actually played pretty well. It did not last. So it was over for Heath. Now, I think Heath was just a miss by everybody. Like, overrated his athleticism, overrated his arm talent. He just wasn't good. I mean, there's just no – I don't think it was like a work ethic thing or anything like that. He just couldn't play. He's had a very nice post-career. He's a politician. He's won elections in Tennessee. So he's had a really nice – I think everything turned out great for him. But it did not turn out great for me as a fan or my hat.
Okay. Well, that was kind of brutal on, but it's just fun to hear some things that you've done that you can get some ragging for. So that's,
yes. Well, they believe me, we can do a top 100 on that if you'd like someday.
No, that's okay.
Choose your play, grind it out with a run, pick up steady gains on a short pass, or risk it all with a long pass for a massive chunk of yardage. It isn't just a quiz, it's a march for glory. It's the Pigskin Trivia Drive. Remember, when the huddle's over, when you pick your play, the faster you answer, the more yards you gain. Hesitation is the enemy of the end zone. Keep those chains moving. Cross that yellow line to reset your downs and earn a critical audible. Stuck on a tough defensive look? Use those audibles to strip away two wrong answers and find your open receiver. Watch the play clock. You've got just 25 seconds to make the read. Take too long, and it's a 5-yard penalty for delay a game. It's game action. In this stadium, your brain is the engine, but the clock is the opponent. The mission is simple. Score as many touchdowns as possible in 5 minutes, and when the clock hits zero, your score hits the global leaderboard. Are you a bench warmer or a Hall of Famer? Step up to the line. Your drive starts now on PigskinDispatch.com, the Trivia Drive. Don't let your football history knowledge go to waste. Try the Pigskin Trivia Drive on PigskinDispatch.com. And now, let's get back into our program.
Okay, well, I think maybe we should get into some of our candidates that are had a much better careers.
Sure. So I just had, we're going to do our top five. I really only had one real honorable mention because there's a lot of players that were good, but there weren't a whole lot that pushed my top five. I didn't have a hard time getting to a top five on this one. But the one that I did struggle with was Cortez Kennedy. He did not make my list. He's in the Hall of Fame, drafted in 1990. This is a great stat. He was the Defensive Player of the Year in 1992 in the league for a team that went 2-14. So the Seahawks were horrible, but he was so good that everybody recognized him out there. And, you know, he was that very traditional, more of a nose defensive tackle, but he still collapsed the pocket. He was a great player. Unfortunately, he died of heart failure at 48, which is really sad. But he does have the gold jacket. He was a pretty easy one, but he didn't quite make the top five.
Okay. All right. So who did make your top five?
Number five is, you know, I've given the Browns a lot of heck, but I am going to put one of their guys here at number five. Number five is Joe Thomas, taken in 2007 as an offensive tackle by the Browns. It's really pretty simple, Darren. He played 11 seasons. He made 10 Pro Bowls. He made 6 All Pros. He's on the All-Decade team. And he played in 0 playoff games. So even when the Browns get it right, they kind of still get it wrong because they can't, you know, take advantage of this Hall of Fame left tackle that was there. But it does not take away from how good he was or his place in league history.
Yeah, he pretty good player, that's for sure. Right, so who do you have up next?
This was kind of tough because number four the next three guys, okay, really the next four could probably go in any order, and I just kind of landed. So number four for me is Andre Johnson. 2003 wide receiver taken by the Texans. He was the first great Texan, football Texan at least. Apologies to all the Cowboys out there. He had a slightly slow start in a struggling offense, and then he had 5 straight 100-plus catch seasons. Say that again. 5 straight 100-plus catch seasons. He is 11th all-time in yards. He is 12th all-time in catches. Now, this is interesting because you remember him as a really tall, big, imposing guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not even in the top 50, though, of reception touchdowns, which is kind of weird.
Yeah,
not even top 50. So he wasn't getting the end zone much. But maybe it was because, not to disparage these guys too much, but he basically played his entire career with David Carr and Matt Schaub as his quarterbacks. He did have 1 year, I think, with Fitzgerald there at the end. Fitzpatrick, I'm sorry, there at the end. But Johnson was older by then, past his prime. But, you know, Carr was kind of a disappointment, and Schaub was okay, you know. And so he never even came close to playing with, like, a Pro Bowl level or better quarterback. Only played in 4 playoff games. In those 4 playoff games, he was really pretty productive. Just very obvious that he was an Hall of Fame receiver. And probably would have done even better had he been in a better situation.
Yeah, I think that's true of some other great receivers that have been on some bad teams. Oh, okay, so who do you have up after him?
I think I'm going to get flogged for this one. People are going to – a lot of my friends especially are going to try to jump through the computer screens, and I'll get blown up for this. But number three, I've got Barry Sanders. 1989. Yeah, that face you made. Right? I got reasons, Darren. Barry Sanders, 1989, running back for the Lions. So 10 seasons. He was very healthy in those seasons. He missed five games in 1993, and even then he was over 1,100 yards. He then had 1,300 yards in all the other seasons. He is fourth all-time in yards. He is 11th in touchdowns. If you're going to ding him for anything at all, and this is kind of pushing it, is he did okay in his – he played in six playoff games. He did okay in his first three. In his last three playoff games, he got totally shut down, including one game where he had negative yards rushing. So he didn't do much in like the few big games he got in. He wasn't much of a factor. Hard to blame him for that, to be honest. For example, they played the 91 NFC Championship game in Washington. That team was so much better than Detroit. Sanders didn't stand a chance. So I don't really ding him for that. But the two guys that are ahead of him, I think, deserve to be ahead of him, and I'll explain why. It's no mark against Barry Sanders. Me personally, based on all these lists we see, I probably have Barry just a tad lower on the all-time great list than some do. But we're talking, maybe I've got Peyton ahead of him, or Emmett, you know, and other people have Barry ahead of that, or whatever. He's a top five-ish running back of all time. So Save your pitchforks for somebody else, because it's just a little unfortunate that he's behind these two.
Okay. So who do you have in front of Barry Sanders?
Well, you're going to like this one, I think, Darren, because number two is Larry Fitzgerald. He is a 2004 wide receiver from the Cardinals. I think, Darren, that Jerry Rice is the best receiver of all time, and you can't argue that. But if you were going to find a guy to argue it, I think it's Fitzgerald. Okay, if you were going to try to pull out something, I think he's your trick card. He is second in all-time in yards to Jerry Rice. He is second all-time in catches to Jerry Rice. And he is sixth all-time in touchdowns. So he's got the numbers. And then again, you go to situation, right? Arizona, not a great place. Traditionally, not a great organization. So I think just watching the guy play, every time I watched him, I was like, that's the best player on the field. That's the best player on the field. He made a game-winning play against your team in the Super Bowl. His team just didn't have the ball last. So he did it all. Larry Fitzgerald, I would rank him just slightly above Barry Sanders because he did it for quite a bit longer.
And he's a Western Pennsylvania guy.
That's, I know. So, I know. Yes.
Pitt Panthers.
I know. But
he has kind of an interesting story because his father, I believe, was like an assistant coach for the Vikings.
Yep.
And he was the ball boy for helping out Chris Carter and you know, some of those guys. I think Randy Moss might have been there when he was doing some of this stuff. And so he's learning from some of the best receivers, you know, in NFL history. And must have took his lessons well because he did it really good in college and in pro football.
And a great dude, a great guy that played with a lot of joy and a lot of passion. Very fun to watch. Was very a lot of his career very buried out there in Arizona. You know, not a lot of national games, things like that. But man, one of the best ever.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, so who do you have number one?
Let's talk about the best ever. And that is number one is Anthony Munoz, taken in 1980, offensive tackle by the Bengals. Now, there's no sense in me trying to, because we've talked about this before with offensive linemen. There's no numbers I can use to compare, right? There's no, well, this guy had so many catches, this guy had so many yards. How do you rank this guy? How do you possibly rank Anthony Munoz over Barry Sanders, right? Because we're not talking about impact so much, because then our list would be kind of all quarterbacks. You know, so we're just trying to find the best players that were the best at their position. And the reason I have Munoz number one, Darren, is because it's subjective and it's kind of analytical and sort of narrative. But if you go, there's been a lot of publications, articles written over time where they tried to figure out who the best offensive lineman in NFL history is. Anthony Munoz is number one or two on 100% of those lists. So no matter what metric you try to find, whether you're trying to go backwards and do some next-gen type stats or you just do an oral history from people that played against them, Munoz is always number one. Everybody says that dude is the best offensive tackle we've ever seen. And to me, there's just no reason to argue it. I think Anthony Munoz is the best offensive lineman probably in the history of the NFL. I think he kind of stands alone in that regard in a lot of ways. So he's number one for me.
Okay. I mean, you have some merit for what you're saying. I don't know that I still have a problem with Barry Sanders being number three on that list because I think he was that special of a player that maybe that transcends some of the Munoz and Fitzgerald.
So you think he's better than Fitzgerald?
I think he was more important to the NFL as a player than those other.
That's a different question though.
So because of that, I would rank him higher than the other two, but that's just my opinion. That's what's fun about opinions.
And I certainly wouldn't argue that Barry Sanders is a much more important figure in the history of the NFL than Anthony Munoz. No question. No kids today are dialing up YouTube highlights of Anthony Munoz the way right. they are Barry Sanders. That's a fact.
And I'm not even going to get into the what if, you know, retiring early, that whole thing, because that was, you know, it was probably because of the teams he played on.
Right.
He probably just got tired of it. But, you know, I think there's some legitimacy. He gets compared to Emmitt Smith a lot because they played in the same time frame. I guess compared a little bit to Walter Payton because they played in the same division for a short period of time. But I think you hit Barry Sanders on either the Bears or the Cowboys of their eras and you switch him up. I think it's a whole different scenario. I think, he may be the NFL leading rusher. And
I'm not sure I agree with that. He had very good offensive lines. They didn't have good teams. They were not – the Lions are a bad organization, but they had very good offensive lines. Lomas Brown was great. Kevin Glover was great. They had Eric Andelsek for a lot of years. Their offensive line was really good.
But who was – I mean, you talked about it earlier. Who was going to throw the ball for Detroit? Where was the threat on offense? It was all – defenses could just lean back and stack the box and, okay, Barry Sanders is the offense. There's not really much other threat that was going to happen.
Well, they had those run-and-shoot years with Herman Moore going for, like, you know – 1900 yards receiving in the mid 90s there that, you know, he may have benefited from it being spread out. I'm not trying to disparage his career.
We didn't have, you know, a Troy Aikman throwing to Irvin or some of the things that the Bears were doing, you know, he didn't have that, or, you know, a great defense on the other side.
True.
It was all him. The Detroit Lions were Barry Sanders.
And that could balance either way, because when we talked about the triplets in Dallas, we also talked about how they could have almost hurt each other, meaning Michael Irvin's stats probably were hurt a little bit by the fact that they did everything else so well and vice versa. So I think you can look at it either way. And the fact that he retired early, he did retire early. So, you know, I can't project. I'm sure he would have broken all the records.
Well, like I said, I'm not going to even put in that things because you could have the same argument about Jim Brown and because he retired a little earlier than
because his career
very, very similar. But his impact when he did play was tremendous. And he was he's a video game before they were popular.
And I do think he probably is the all-time highlight dial upper in terms of. Going back, I would say that he's probably number one on that list.
Okay. We won't beat a dead horse or
okay
any further, but all great players. So, you know, it's a fun topic to discuss here on that.
Why we're here.
Right. Right. Well, this, the Hall of Famers at number three it's unbelievably, this is sort of almost gets into our draft fact of the day. There is more third pick Hall of Famers than any other pick that we've talked about, which astounds me. Spoiler for the next 2 days, but 15 of them that we've had. We've had some 13s. We had a 14 in the last few days, but 15 Hall of Famers here. Some of the ones that we did not talk about yet before 1980, we had Claude Humphrey. In 1968, Dick Butkus in 65, 64, Charlie Taylor of the Washington, Merlin Olsen by the Rams in 62, Johnny Robinson was a defensive back with the Lions before that, back in 1960. Ollie Mattson by the Cardinals, part of that million-dollar backfield in 1952. Bobby Lane by the Bears in 48, and Doak Walker by the Brooklyn NYB. It must be the Brooklyn Dodgers, I'm thinking, back in 49. But probably the most interesting is Y.A. Tittle. And we talked about Y.A. Tittle just a few days ago as the sixth pick. You know, and he was picked by the Detroit Lions in 1948. So now we come to 1951. He's in the NFL draft again. And how could that be? The history is kind of interesting because San Francisco took him in the 48. The Lions took him in the NFL, but he signed a professional contract with the Cleveland Browns, who were in the All-American Football Conference until 1949. So he backed up Otto Graham, who we just talked about the other day. A year later, he was traded to the New York Yankees in the AAFC, who sent him to the Baltimore Colts, who were in the AAFC. When the leagues finally merged, there were some teams that were allowed to pick up so many players, but players on the roster at the time when the Colts end up folding, it's not the same Colts that we know today. It was the original Baltimore Colts. When they folded, all those players on the rosters were eligible to go back in the NFL draft in 1951. And a la that, we have Y.A. Tittle getting drafted again, this time by the San Francisco 49ers, who are also formerly an AAFC team. So
that's very confusing.
Yeah, very confusing. But he was in two NFL drafts. He was drafted twice, 3 years apart. So
that's pretty cool.
Kind of unbelievable.
And all of those guys you mentioned, Darren, were better than Barry Sanders. I kid. Yeah,
yesterday we could say that, but I would say probably the last 40-some years, the players you talked about would probably be your top five.
I'm joking. Everybody calm down.
Even, maybe Butkus and Bobby Lane, I don't know if they would even hold a candle to get on there. So that is just a real quick, another added bonus draft stat of the day. Of the 21 players with 7 All-Pro appearances, 20 went in the rounds 1 or 2. So that's no surprise to anybody there. So just tells you the importance of the first and second round players picked. And we're definitely into those. We are getting right around the corner here. Tomorrow we will talk about the second pick overall in the NFL draft, the first 90 drafts, and have some more exciting players in. Ed, I'd love to talk to you about that.
I'll see you tomorrow, Darren.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part. because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.